I want to remind you of the time when I would not have been up on this platform. I thank everybody who was involved in the redo of this sanctuary because you've made my presence here possible. We all know who Leonard Bernstein was, I think. He was an awesome musician. He said, "It's all about humanity and about living an authentic life." And Judy Blume, an author whom I began reading when I was much younger, said, "When unexpected tragedies occur, we can get through it. We can do it. We can." I've been part of a seminar, workshop, class that was working on writing, planning worship, writing sermons, writing reflections. And we talk about our own theological perspectives because you can't write or do something like this without figuring out what your own is. Many of us do not describe ourselves as theists or deists. We're in a bit of a muddle with that word theology because it really means God talk. We've continued our conversations, though, in spite of the things that we can't make any sense of or really reconcile. I wanted to share with you this morning how I come down on these issues. I think that the word humanist is the closest fit for me, even though I grew up in households that were part of Protestant Christianity or Reformed Judaism. I'm not sure what kind of adjective ought to go with humanism. I'm not a religious humanist, but I'm not a secular humanist either. So another one of my reasons for doing this service is to figure out what kind of humanist I might be. I'm hoping that we can strengthen the concept that this congregation is really based on. It's a big tent concept, and it says we have myriads of perspectives here in this room and among the people who are not here with us this morning, and we continue to become more inclusive, less exclusive all the time, so that people increasingly feel that there is a place for them here, whatever our theological perspectives. I think that makes me a communitarian. J. Edgar Hoover notwithstanding. Humanism was a philosophy that really started in the Renaissance in Europe. It was at a time when there were deep divisions among Roman Catholics and Orthodox, Protestant Christians, Islam, and Judaism. Two big things happened in this period. People loved to read ancient writers of drama and science too, and they wanted to be able to translate those better. And the thing that helped them to do it was invented in 1450. It was the printing press. That meant you didn't have to keep copying books by hand, but you could print books, and it helped in their language acquisition. So as they translated those things, they used the translations of those texts then to write their different stuff. And the second one was that they stopped thinking that the hand of God had come down from wherever to do something to make this grow and then enable us to use it for something else. Well, they started looking and listening and smelling and taking bodies apart and doing those scientific things. And then they started creating hypotheses or ideas that said, this is how we think things work. And the more they began to look at how things really were instead of how they might have been, the more scientific they got. These scholars were known as humanists because they were using human learning and human skills and talents to reshape university education, and some of them paid for that dearly with their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. Eppur si muove, and yet it moves, Galileo said under his breath. He was being forced by the acquisition, by the Inquisition, to give up his belief that it was the earth that moved around the sun and not vice versa. And yet it moves, he said. The scientific evidence that we rely on today is based on the work of those Renaissance humanists. Their methods and their perspectives are still with us. Well, a lot happened between the Renaissance of the 16th century and the 20th century. America went through the Great Awakening, went through the establishment of Mormonism, and they learned that gunpowder can blow people away a lot quicker than guys on horseback and a cavalry riding up with sabers. the universalists, who were known as the no-hellers, came along and told us, you know, if there is a God, he loves us too much to send us to hell. And the Unitarians thought a lot and wrote a lot. They were known for their intellectual skills, and they created what they called a learned ministry. You had to learn things about theology before you could be ordained and serve as a minister. And that included the transcendentalists like Thoreau and Emerson. In science in America in the early part of the 20th century, this guy named Charles Darwin wrote On the Origin of Species. He described a process that he called evolution, in which we, human beings, didn't arise some thousand years ago. We are related to great apes and hominids, and that led directly to the Scopes monkey trial, because in Tennessee, the school board at that time said, you know, we shouldn't be teaching our children these things. Well, the process of evolution, while it's still a process and still an open question, I think most of us have come to accept. That was the time when Einstein was writing the theory of relativity, and when Margaret Sanger separated the act of human sexuality from conception and reproduction. Robert Ingersoll traveled around the United States, talked about to huge audiences that the belief in God that he had grown up with was not only unnecessary, it was actually antithetical to our learning more about the world in which we live. Bertrand Russell, who was an English philosopher and author, published Why I Am Not a Christian, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and other women like her wrote a woman's Bible in which they explored the ways in which very traditional Christianity had actually held women down instead of giving the opportunity to learn what it would be like as a woman to be a citizen and, perish the thought, vote. John Dewey described his beliefs in universal education. He wanted to start with kindergarten. He wanted to use curricula that were derived from the world around us, where children learn not because they're sitting in rows forced because we tell them so. They don't have little heads that we open up and pour information in. They have to learn from the world around them. They have to practice what they want to practice, and that is how children learn. There was a new philosophy called logical positivism that described religious statements as basically meaningless unless they're tied to the world around us. Europeans were still trying to figure out what to do in the aftermath of the Great War. Germany, by the Treaty of Versailles, was forced to pay massive reparations. They resented it bitterly. It's one of the reasons why a rather insignificant, unimportant little guy named Adolf Hitler was appointed by Paul von Hindenburg as Chancellor of Germany. We don't sometimes know what's going to come out of what seems to be a rather simple and insignificant decision. In 1933, the world was getting further and further away from Renaissance humanism, very, very different from the 19th century. People who espoused their belief in the scientific method, though, were increasing, and one of those men was a guy named Raymond Bragg. He was a Unitarian minister. He was the secretary of the Western Unitarian Conference. That was a group of Unitarians who affirmed their desire, and I'm quoting now, to establish truth, righteousness, and love in the world. And they claimed that a belief in God was not necessary if you wanted to be Unitarian. So he set out to create a document that would put all of those things in sort of an easy way to understand. He created the First Humanist Manifesto. It was published in 1933. It was signed before publication by 34 people. Half of them were either Unitarians or Universalists. And here are the tenets of humanism that he set out in that document. Humanism is a philosophy for people who are in love with life. Humanists take responsibility for their own lives, and they relish the adventure of being part of new discoveries, seeking new knowledge, exploring new options, and instead of finding solace in prefabricated answers to the great questions of life, humanists enjoy the open-endedness of a quest and the freedom of discovery that this entails. Well, two additional manifestos have been written since then, one in 1993 and one in 2003, and they added these things to our belief in humanism at the beginning of the 21st century. Knowledge of how this world works is derived by observation, by experimentation, and by rational analysis. Humans are an integral part of nature. the result of evolutionary change, which is an unguided process. We derive ethical values from human need and interest as tested by experience. Life's fulfillment emerges from individual participation in the service of humane ideals. Human beings are social by nature. They find their greatest meaning in relationships. Working to benefit society is what is the way to be happy. And respect for differing yet humane views in an open, secular, democratic, environmentally sustainable process is our civic duty. So those are the things that humanists really believe in. If you've wondered what humanists are, that's who they are. They might sound similar to the things that have been written up as our principles and purposes. And I think if sometime you look in the Singing the Living tradition, you'll find that our principles and purposes reflect many of those views. As you use, we include people who consider themselves theists, Christians, deists, spiritualists, just plain religious, and agnostics and atheists too. It's a philosophy on which many of us base our beliefs. We might have moved away from how James Freeman Clarke wrote it in his 5 points of the New Theology. This was at the end of the late 19th century. We believe in the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, the leadership of Jesus, salvation by character, and continuity of human development in all worlds, the progress of humankind onward and upward forever. We may no longer follow William Ellery Channing's belief that when you're not at work, you should be in a class. You should be learning something. So if you've been wasting your time frivolously, going down to the pub, give it up. I think there isn't any question, though, that our beliefs in humanism separate us from faith communities of Christians and Jews and Muslims. The question for me is whether we can create and maintain a tent that's big enough for all these perspectives. Our youth compiled a survey recently. I hope some of you have had a chance to talk to them about what that meant to them, because we're all in here. We all identified ourselves someplace on that survey. So what is it that humanists actually do? And to me, very importantly, what is it that makes humanists laugh? I went out and put into Google, tell me some humanist humor, and this is what I got back. I found a cartoon of an old man with a beard, you know, that version of God, and he's saying, I can heal you if you just have enough faith. Unless you're an amputee, of course. Tough luck with that, Stumpy. A tombstone on which is written the words, all dressed up and no place to go. And from a New Yorker cartoon, two guys up to their necks in a swamp, they're holding their rifles over their heads, and the man in the back is saying to the one in front, say what you like, McMurtry, quicksand or no, I've got half a mind to struggle. I found those examples in a rather long article in the New Yorker, something I read regularly. The article was very rational, very explanatory. And the real joke is that's what humanists do. They talk about humor and they think about it and they figure out what role humor plays in our lives and how they'll be better if we laugh. It's why some of us subscribe to New Yorker and read the cartoons first instead of the table of contents. I don't think I'm a secular humanist. I don't believe in the kind of deity that most people mean when they use the word God. So I don't think I'm a religious humanist either. I don't really know what description fits. Here's another example of how this works in my life anyway. My wife, who's sitting in the soprano section, her name is Susan, and she was on her way to help facilitate the recent board retreat, which was out in the Tulies down 25 South, and she couldn't really make any sense out of the MapQuest directions. She was a bit nervous about finding the place, so of course the night before we watched the weather forecast to see whether she should take an umbrella or a jacket. And the weather forecast told her that it was going to be kind of a nice day, so she went off to find this place. And when she went out to get the newspaper for me before she left, she came back in laughing. She said, what'd they say last night about the weather? And I said, high humidity, but no rain till afternoon and highs in the mid-80s. Well, she said, it's raining. And we both cracked up. So that's in a nutshell. We are both humanists of a sort, but we're just not sure what sort. She can speak for herself, but for me, I think we have one life, right here, on this rather fragile little planet, where life and consciousness have evolved somehow. We are a rather destructive species. I think, in fact, that we are the most destructive species that has ever lived. I think we are the only species that has the unmitigated goal to think we can destroy the environment which has given us life and figure out a way to make it right. That frightens me. I don't know about the long-term future of this particular evolutionary experiment. And we worry about different things at different times. Do you remember when it was the hole in the ozone layer compared to climate change? Not so much. There isn't really time to go deeply this morning into the things that concern me. They are myriad. And one of the things that I believe in most deeply is the importance of relationships and a beloved community. The fact that you all got up this morning, got dressed, and are sitting here among us to create this beloved community, this one right here, where we can talk about the things that make us afraid in the middle of long and sleepless nights. I treasure poetry and art and music. I love those things. I don't mind ritual. I can live with it. And when push comes to shove, it's going to be human beings and their little foibles that I care about and think about. When I consider the intersection, this is a gesture that we're hoping that we can teach you. This is my own interests. These are the world's needs. And right there at the intersection of my interests and the world's needs, that's what we ought to be talking about. So we're hoping that some of you pick that gesture up because it's useful for figuring out what we're going to do. I think it makes me the kind of person who welcomes everybody here. Anybody who wants to come in that door, unless it's a person who wants to hurt us. And that's a limit. That's not okay. And that, incidentally, is why Skip sits back there every single week. Skip sits back there to protect us, because there was a time when someone came into a Unitarian Universalist congregation with a gun. And so that man who sits back there by the flowers says, they'll have to get through me first. Wow. Wow. I hope that except for those people who think we shouldn't be here, even a few Muslim UUs, the Unitarian Universalists, the agnostics and the atheists, the people whose spirituality is earth-centered, all the humanists, the theists, and the atheists, all together, I hope we are all learning better about how to get along. I hope that my right brain interests in art and music and language can continue to find a place here too. Lectures are fine, but for me, they're not enough. My mother used to describe music as a bridge between this world and the next. And for me, this is the only world there is, but I do think about music as a bridge that leads between what's rational and what is not. How about you? Is humanism part of what makes you tick? How does it fit? Let's talk.